You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 14th, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
This was one of those heavy news weeks, heavy science news week. I suspect that two of the news items we're going to talk about this week are going to be two of the biggest science news items of the year. If not one and two, I think they'll both be in the top five. They're big. We'll get to them in a minute. But first, there's another sort of big item that's a follow-up to last week. Now, last week I gave the follow-up to the AstraZeneca blood clot issue. This is the European main European vaccine, AstraZeneca, for COVID, and there has been some reported blood clots. Most of them are probably not above background. However, there was one subset of clots in young people, like less than 50, mostly women, specifically in the brain, CVST, cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, associated with thrombocytopenia, low blood platelets, which are the clotting elements in the blood. So that was unusual.
Yeah, and Steve, yeah, isn't another factor that the symptoms arose within 2 to 4 weeks after the shot?
Yeah, within like 16 days.
Commonality.
Or something. Yeah, yeah. So they were within the time frame of the vaccine.
How could you have clotting and low platelet count? So I'm sure that's in your description somewhere.
Well, yeah, because they're dysfunctional platelets is the problem, right? Mm. So there's low number, but they're causing clotting.
All right.
Yeah, and then there's been a couple of different publications, including one recently in the New England Journal of Medicine, looking at potential mechanisms. It's certainly plausible that it is a vaccine-induced autoimmune disease causing this clotting situation. But the numbers are extremely low, the absolute numbers, and there's still some heated debate about the risk versus benefit. Like, you're going to be saving thousands of lives with the vaccine, and one or two people will die, that sort of thing. But, that we're comparing that to, but we don't want to freak people out about the vaccine, and we want to make sure we're being transparent. And yeah, so it's like this total mess. Well, the mess just got doubled because the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has the same thing now. There have been six reported cases of CVST, the cerebral venous venous thrombosis, with thrombocytopenia in women between the ages of 18 and 48. So the same demographics, the same kind of clinical picture, the same blood clot, same time frame, 1 to 2 weeks after the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Also, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and the AstraZeneca vaccine are both adenovirus vaccines. So they're similar. They're not the same. The J&J is a human adenovirus. AstraZeneca is a chimpanzee adenovirus, but they're both modified adenoviruses. They took that virus, they weakened it, they made it produce the protein from the COVID virus so the immune
system. It's old school. It's not mRNA.
It's old school. These are both old school.
Ah, sure.
But fine, they're perfectly cronvalent vaccines. And
I was worried for mRNA though, so I'm not worried anymore.
No. The two mRNA vaccines are kicking ass. I mean, they have the
future,
highest,
baby. It's the future.
They have incredibly high efficacy. They're incredibly safe. There's been no problem. Just to be absolutely clear, like the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, there are no problems with them. 100 million doses and more in the U.S., and there's really no issues. And they've been out longer than the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
But to be clear, with the J&J vaccine, we are seeing it's a very, 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 very rare.
The numbers are similar to the AstraZeneca vaccine in sort of order of magnitude. So there have been, with almost 7 million doses, there have been six cases of the clot, one death. So that's a million to one of developing the clot and, seven to million to one of dying from it.
And all in youngish women?
All in women 18 to 48. 100% in women 18 to 48.
Here's my concern, and this comes up because earlier today on my 900th job, because apparently I'm not doing enough, I also do a live daily hit for my local PBS station every day. And our reporters today covered the fact that Governor Newsom has decided to suspend use here in California. And I think we're starting to see this across a lot of nations, right? And so And it's like, okay, well, we've got enough other vaccines. We're probably okay. We know that only, you know, kids can only take the Pfizer one. 16, 17-year-olds can only take the Pfizer one. So we're covered there. But the concern is that we have such a large population of unhoused individuals. And the one-shot vaccine is so important for public health. And to completely suspend it, even though a vast majority of individuals who would be receiving it are older and men, it worries me that those people might not end up getting the coverage that they need because they might be hard to track down for a second dose.
Yeah, so why can't they just order a limitation on who can receive the Johnson?
Yeah. So, to be clear,
that much more complicated.
Hang on. To be clear, the CDC and the FDA presented a joint statement where they recommended pausing the vaccine. The FDA did not pull its emergency use authorization. They didn't ban it. They didn't stop it. They basically left it up to the states with their recommendation of pausing until they have a chance of investigating these reports. And so the states can do what they feel is necessary depending on how their vaccine rollout is going. So you're correct. The one sort of niche for this vaccine, the J&J vaccine, are the poor because they, as you say, it's a one-shot vaccine. It's easier for that to happen than to schedule two shots. It's also doesn't need the cold chain. You can refrigerate it. So rural areas, it's better for rural areas. But
it's just more convenient. It's way more convenient.
Absolutely. But. However, this is complicated. If you look at the big picture, it's less than 5% of the total doses given have been J&J. So it's a very tiny part of America's vaccine rollout. The other thing is there was a huge problem. They tried to shift their manufacture to Baltimore, to the United States. I think it was in they had Dutch factories making it. And there was a problem with contamination and millions of doses had to be thrown away. So we're actually in the middle of a shortage of J&J vaccine right when this happened. So already people were not able to get the J&J vaccine. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting, just coincidence.
Yeah.
And if you crunch the numbers, again, this I know there might be subpopulations that this could affect, but if you look at the numbers, between the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines, they are putting out enough vaccines, more than 3 million a day, to keep up with our ability to get shots in people's arms and to keep up with demand. And so this is probably not going to delay.
It seems like here in California, the demand is fine. The issue is, are there people who we won't be able to reach? And, you know, would we have been able to if we had a single shot vaccine available to us?
So you have to factor all this together. And again, if you run the calculation, those 7 million people who got the J&J vaccine, that saved thousands of lives compared to one person who died from the side effect. So, risk versus benefit is on the favor of giving the vaccine. But and we do this all the time. The FDA will approve a drug that, has a 1 in a million death toll. That's not a deal killer for a drug. Mm-hmm. You just get a black box warning. And then they wanted physicians to be fully aware of the side effect that you don't treat it like you normally treat blood clots. They wanted patients to report symptoms. So this is partly for public awareness. It's partly for transparency. And, each state has to make a decision about whether or not what the risk versus benefit is. I do, unfortunately, think that this is going to lead increased vaccine hesitancy, but it was going to do that no matter how they handled it. Just the mere fact of it was going to do that no matter how they handled it.
Yeah, it's very tough to do this right PR-wise.
Yeah. So you have to kind of spin it. You have to say, well, this is proof that the system is working. We have a very careful monitoring system in place. It picked this up with very few numbers. We're being very cautious. This vaccine hasn't been out nearly as long as Pfizer or Moderna. And so those two vaccines have had many more doses over a longer period of time with nothing showing, no red flags cropping up. So the system is working and your faith in the system should be pretty high. And we could quibble about this decision because it's a hard one, but there are people who are praising the decision and people who are criticizing it for the reasons that we just reviewed because it's a no-win scenario. So we just got to pick the lesser of two evils here. They did the best job they could, I think, in terms of making a decision. Again, you could argue that, but again, they didn't pull it. So just to be clear, they just made a recommendation of pausing it. The states are deciding whether or not to pause it. And I think that, and most states are, but like in Connecticut, we don't need the J&J vaccine. We're doing fine with the other two, and it's not going to delay anyone getting a vaccine who wants it at all. So if for states like that, fine. And definitely there's no downside to pausing it. But in rural states and poor states, you know, it may cause some delays.
Isn't the downside that the people whose lives would have been saved, that's not going to happen?
Well, what I'm saying is, in a state where they can just substitute Moderna and Pfizer with no delay in vaccination, then you avoid that. In states where you can't do that, they have to think very carefully about, you know, how much of a delay it's going to cause.
Right. Okay.
Right. That's what I'm saying. You're right in states where that matters. But again, like, there are definitely some states where they have plenty of Pfizer and Moderna vaccine. And some of them are even saying, if you were scheduled to get a J&J vaccine, we'll give you a Moderna vaccine. Just show up and you'll get your vaccine. You know, there's no delay.
Awesome.
Well, and in a lot of places, you can't even choose.
Well, yeah, but I'm saying if you were already scheduled for the J&J.
Right.
They don't even have to reschedule you. They'll just give you a different vaccine. Yeah.
Yeah.
But sometimes some states have to reschedule, and we'll see. We'll see how it plays out in every state. So it's unfortunate, you know, but it's not, hey, you know, we think of how many different vaccines we cranked out in a year.
Oh, yeah.
When you study it in 10, 20, 30, 40,000 people, and then you give it to millions, of course things are going to crop up when you give it to millions. Mm-hmm. And it's what's going to crop up are these rare things that happen one in a million. You're not going to see a one in a million side effect when you study 40,000 people. This is
right,
there's no way right. to avoid this. That's why we have the monitoring system that we do to pick this up when it happens. And so I also think like the FDA said they're acting out of an abundance of caution. So I wonder if like how much they adjusted their standard operating procedure to the fact that we're in the middle of a pandemic. You know what I mean? Because if there was not a pandemic, this is a no-brainer. This is easy. You pause it, you collect the data, you study it. But when, you know, pausing it can cost thousands of lives, then the calculation is different. And yeah. It's, you know, so they just had a very, just like with the European countries, they made a bunch of different decisions. I think the UK nailed it, where they didn't pause it. They waited for the data. And then once it came in, they said, all right, we're not going to give this to young women or people who are low risk for COVID. We're going to just give it to older populations. They kind of slipped right into, I think, what the best risk management scenario that there is.
Yeah.
You know? But anyway, we're totally Monday morning quarterbacking all of this. Absolutely. But hey.
Yeah, we have all that. I mean, we still don't actually have all the information. And that's the interesting thing about this unrolling, you know, in real time.
Yeah.
Steve, I heard that they were going to have a big meeting today and really talk about, you know, did anything come out of that specific meeting today?
I haven't seen. I think they were going to start meeting today. I don't know if they were going to issue any statements today, probably later this week or early next week, I would expect. I mean, they're definitely fast tracking it. So more cases are going to come forward just because of underreporting, but also there are people who are still in the window. Like they got their vaccine 3 days ago and they're still kind of in that 2 week window. There definitely will be more cases. The current count is an underreport, but it's still going to be, I think, similar to what we're seeing now, you know, single digits per million people vaccinated. But the other thing is, like, when I wrote about this in Science-Based Medicine, this is sort of my conclusion. It's like, yeah, this is unfortunate, but it's par for the course. This is what it's like to roll out new medications, and we monitor them and we respond appropriately. Everything is playing out exactly as it should, you know, when you really think about it. The real vulnerability is the epidemic, the pandemic of misinformation that's out there. The fact that this is happening on a background of a anti-vaccine misinformation campaign playing out over social media. And so they're really causing a lot of havoc. And that is a vulnerability for our society. That we talked about this last week, and I want to get into it again, but we got to deal with that. We have to deal with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. If we're already struggling with distrust.
Yeah.
And then something that we totally expected could have potentially happens, but we communicate it or we telegraph it poorly, then in many ways, simply how we contextualize this can contribute to that distrust. So we have to be very careful.
Yeah. I mean, the challenge is we need 7.5 billion people to all make rational decisions at the same time.
Exactly.
And it's just
no problem.
Yeah. It's hard. Yeah.
We'll need a day or two.
It's a high bar.
But do we have any sort of good evidence yet based on the growing numbers and these more controlled places like college campuses or, you know, closed places of where herd immunity looks like it needs to net out?
What I do know, I actually read a study today, but of course, these data is always months behind by the time the data gets collected, analyzed, published, you know, is that so far that we could tell that social distancing and mask wearing is having a greater impact than herd immunity. Mm-hmm. So the herd immunity piece hasn't kicked in yet.
Okay, but, so we're not quite there yet in terms of the percentage.
Yeah. But the data is, of course, lagging behind the reality in the ground. I mean, we probably won't know that we're there until 6 weeks after we are. You know what I mean?
Well, and even as of today, aren't we only like 25% or something fully vaccinated?
Fully vaccinated?
Fully. I think it's still pretty low. Like, I wouldn't think herd immunity would be, we'd be anywhere close to it quite yet. I'm just wondering, based on modeling, where do we need to be? Is it 80%? Is it 60%? Is it 90%?
We don't know that number. We'll know that number in retrospect.
When we get to it.
I've heard 80%, but
it's a good guesstimate, but we don't really know. Yeah. And unfortunately, if you look at the number of new cases per day, it's starting to turn back up.
Mm. Yeah, I've seen that, especially in like specific pockets as well.
Yeah, we're not out of this yet.
You know, now that millions of people have it, we're seeing something. What happens when, you know, we get over a billion people get the vaccine? I mean, you think anybody could be like a superhero? Too soon?
Well, like a billion, what's the billion to one reaction?
Yeah.
Superpowers? Yeah, maybe that's what we should tell people. Hey, one person in a billion is going to be getting superpowers.
Yeah, that's like a golden ticket. Make it a lottery, yes.
Yeah, don't miss out on your chance. That's you could be the one.
Can't win if you don't get inoculated.
Yeah, but then people will get it multiple times.
Oh, my God.
Right. Oh, damn.
No, we have to tell them that will undo it. If you get it,
oh, that's
redundant
right.
Vaccines, yes. It will nullify it your chance of getting it.
Gives you evil superpowers.
I mean,
yes. All right. Well, we have some really exciting news items to talk about this week. You're going to start us off with the possibility of a new particle or force.
No way.
Yeah, this is everywhere. I've seen this so many times. Definitely had to talk about this. So potentially big, or at least very interesting news from the world of particle physics this past week. Particles called muons have been observed behaving in a way not predicted by the incredibly successful standard model of physics, which we've talked about a lot on the show. Does this mean finally that there's a major update for physics, a major cool new discoveries, or perhaps is this just a minor tweak, or is this probably nothing? So what's going on? So this comes from Fermilab's long-awaited experiments on muons and recently published in the journal Physical Review Letters. Now, at a high level, what's happened is scientists have accelerated muons in a magnetic field, and the high precision measurements confirm and extend the and greatly refine previous measurements that don't agree with theory. The superficial excitement here, of course, is that this could portend new physics that could finally give some insights into some of physics' biggest mysteries: dark energy, dark matter, combining general relativity and quantum mechanics. I mean, who knows? I mean, that's best case scenarios are very, very exciting. First of all, though, I would like to congratulate the hundreds of scientists all over the world who collaborated on this extraordinary feat. And like for decades, they've been working on this. Literally, they've been working on this specific outcome since the 1990s, measuring muons in this way. And it really was a tour de force of awesomeness. So regardless of what happens, bravo, brava to all the men and women who have worked on this. So what are the facts? More specifically, what the hell is a muon? And is it called a muon or is it a muon? I think it's pronounced muon. A lot of scientists I listened to the past few days are saying muon. So I will say that.
Is that because of the Greek letter mu?
Yeah. And I've been calling it muon for God knows how long, but oh well.
That's all right. Wait,
so muon?
Muon.
Oh, muon.
Yes.
Muon.
Mew. Yeah. That's a noise. So you can think of a muon as essentially a corpulent cousin of an electron.
Corpulent.
Same thing, but just more massive, like over 200 times as massive. They are truly elementary particles, meaning that there is no internal structure. It's a point particle, unlike an atom or even a proton. They all have internal structure. There's also a third cousin as well, and he or she is called tau. And that's even more massive. He's the most corpulent-licious version of these bad boys. And together, they are leptons. They are part of the family of leptons. You may have heard of that. Leptons are fascinating. So there's three, electron, muon, and tau. And those are the charged leptons. There's three others, and they are uncharged. Can you guess what they are? Yes, Bob, you are right. They are the neutrinos. Neutrinos are leptons and very distant third or fourth cousins to electrons and muons and tau particles. And of course, to fill out the lepton family, you got to throw in the antiparticles because they're in there. They're in there as well. So now you're probably wondering, well, if these other electron cousins could orbit atoms like the normal electrons, can, you know, what is that real? Does that happen? Yes, they can. You can have an atom with a tau or muon orbiting instead of a regular electron. But, you know, these are exotic atoms, but they are very short-lived. Muons and taus are unstable. They decay into electrons, which fortunately are extremely stable. But, yeah, any cool atoms like that, if they are created, don't last beyond microseconds. So that's unfortunate. Or maybe it's fortunate because who knows what kind of weird universe we'd live in. exotic atoms everywhere. So, okay, kids, it's time to put on our imagination hats.
Ooh.
If you want a mental image, think of a muon as a tiny ball of charge that's spinning. Mm-hmm. And a spinning charge like this behaves very much like a common bar magnet, you know, straight piece of metal with a red north and a
white
south on, was it a white south
yeah,
on the bottom? haven't seen one of those in a few dog's color. Ages. Now, remember though, mental images like these can definitely help, but remember, these are, they're imperfect mental analogies, but that's probably the best our baseline human minds
speak
can
for
do
yourself.
Right now. So, okay, so this is player one. The muon is player number one in this experiment. Muons have a magnetic field and angular momentum, and our limited minds can think of that as spin, it's often compared to a spinning top or a gyroscope. That's a good way to think about it. See, then after player one, now we've got player number two. And in this experiment, player number two is an intensely controlled external magnetic field that is exposed to and surrounds the muon. So these two guys are kind of like in the same space, the muon with its magnetic field and this external magnetic field. Now, when you introduce this external magnetic field, it causes the two magnetic fields to interact, and that causes the muon spin to precess. The spin axis precesses, and that's roughly analogous, again, to the axis of a spinning top moving, you know, it moves in circles. The ends of the axis, you know, move in circles. That's a good way to think about it. And it's this precession that is the focus of this experiment. And it's this value that is called the G factor. And that this is what they're trying to calculate. They're trying to use this precession to infer the very extremely precise value of the magnetic moment of this muon. So yes, the speed of that precession tells us precisely how strong the muon's magnetic field is. We can then measure the strength and compare it to theory to see if they match. And if they match, then the theory is correct, and that's awesome. We have confirmation of this amazing theory yet again. More confirmation. But if it doesn't match, we may have some new physics. So it's always an interesting possibility. Now, there is a third player here making this kind of like a quantum threesome. Oh. And these are called virtual particles. We've mentioned this on the show, and I love virtual particles. We know that a vacuum is anything but empty, right? You think, the vacuum is the epitome of emptiness. No, not at all. All sorts of particles appear from apparently nothing. But really, it's really they're appearing from the energy inherent in space-time itself. They disappear and they appear and disappear too quickly for the universe to really care. But also, some of these virtual particles, we can't make in any collider that we have on any drawing board. They are just like too massive. They exist for such a brief period of time, we really can't directly examine them, which is unfortunate. But we can investigate them indirectly.
How do they exist in nature then?
Right. At the quantum level, virtual particles appear out of nowhere. They kind of, you know, you have like a particle and antiparticle appear out of nowhere and then hit each other and annihilate and disappear. So, they pop in and out of existence. And they interact. They can interact with particles, and that's what's so important in this context. So these virtual particles surround muons. If you could look at a muon, you would just see them all over the place. And they can interact with the muon and have an impact on this G factor. So we have to take that into account. Okay. So all right, we have muons, which are revealing to us the exact strength of its magnetic field because of the way an external magnetic field and virtual particles affect its precession. That's the big picture of this.
Bob.
This, yo.
Do you know what subatomic cows say?
Mew. Good one, Steve. Okay.
Oh, we were all thinking that.
So now the standard model, though, just laughs at all this complexity. It takes into account all of this and predicts a very, very, very specific value for the G factor, and it's called G-2, which is actually the name of this entire experiment. Now, the accuracy of the prediction in the standard model is 400 parts per billion. Very, very accurate. Now, the Fermilab muon G2 experiment is designed to be accurate to only 150 parts per billion. That's like measuring a football field accurate to a tenth the width of the iconic human hair that's always used in these comparisons. So amazingly accurate. When this initial measurement from Fermilab is compared to theory, it does not match. And this is exciting, obviously, because it means that there could be some unknown virtual particle that smacked the muon in the face and changed its precession in a way that an amazingly accurate landmark theory knows nothing about it. So that's why this has so much potential, because this is something that the standard model just has not predicted. So this is why this could be something that it could be something, you know, tiny and insignificant in some ways, but it also could be the other end of the spectrum, something huge and amazing. Fermilab physicist Chris Polly told the New York Times, "This is our Mars rover landing moment." And Rene Fatemi is a physicist at the University of Kentucky and is also a simulation manager for the muon G-2 experiment, said recently that this is strong evidence that the muon is sensitive to something that is not in our best theory. That's a really good way to put it. And I can't disagree with these scientists, mainly because I'm stupid compared to them. But I can put this in a context that you may find interesting. So as usual, it's premature to celebrate. Do not break out the bubbly for this. I mean, you could do it just for the raw accomplishment itself, but don't pull out your new particle / new force bubbly. I'm going to wait on that. And that's mainly because of our buddy called Sigma. We've mentioned that on the show many times. Experiments, anything that has experiments typically will use Sigma to measure standard deviation, right? And that's used to express, how likely is a result. Is it just random chance or what? And the Sigma can really help us wrap our head around that. Now, Brookhaven National Laboratory did the very first experiments with G-2 in 2001. I mean, God, 2 decades ago. And they found this G factor anomaly. They found this difference between observation and theory. And they calculated Sigma at 3.7, which is, it's okay. Not anywhere near the gold standard of 5 sigma. Now, the first result from Fermilab, the thing that we're talking about right now, this is the first result, the initial result from Fermilab that combines with the Brookhaven, because they're using the same, most of the same equipment. They actually transported the entire ring, to Fermilab. So when you combine the Fermilab results with Brookhaven, it brings it up to, 4.2. Now that's 99.7% probably accurate. There's a 97.7 chance that this is real and not just bad luck. 1 in 40,000. That's good, right? That's good. 1 in 40,000, but that's still nowhere near the gold standard, which is 5 sigma. That's 1 in 3.5 million. So if you're not at 5 sigma and you're making a huge claim, I'm sorry. Wait. Talk to me when you get to 5 sigma, because we cannot assume that this is right, even though there's only a 1 in 40,000 chance that it was a coincidence.
But Bob, let me point out at this point, though, that this assumes that there's no experimental error, right? This is just, if the data is correct, what's the probability that this data occurred by chance alone? 1 in 40,000, 1 in 3.5 million.
Right.
But
right.
It this says nothing about there being some systematic error in the experimental setup,
right,
or in the way they're measuring things. So, like, for example, I believe, if you remember, like the faster than light neutrinos, they were up to 6 sigma with that.
Well, right.
But that doesn't matter because they had a bad cable. The sigma is nothing. It doesn't account for things like,
Yeah. Are they trying to falsify the hell out of this thing?
A hardware problem. So it's not just that when we hit 5 sigma, it's proven. We also need to replicate this with different equipment in different labs.
Right. Absolutely.
There isn't some systematic problem.
Right.
There.
Right. And that's definitely part of the process. And that kind of relates to my next quote by Bruce Shum. He's a professor of physics and he's the author of a popular book on the standard model itself. He said there's a little bit of skepticism that's been cast on it. When you make a measurement and you compare the expectation based on everything we know, the standard model, there's a little bit of concern that maybe the calculation wasn't done quite right. And yes, the standard model has been amazingly, you know, it's almost unparalleled how successful it's been over decades. I mean, it basically lays out all of the forces and particles that we are aware of in physics and its predictions. I mean, we found the Higgs boson based on it, purely on theory, on the predictions of the standard model. We knew that it had to be around, you know, this energy regime, and we found it at the LHC purely because of the standard model. So when you tell me, when you come to me and say, hey, it looks like the standard model got this one bit wrong, and we're at 4.2 sigma, it's like, well, okay, that's great, but, you know, chances are, there's probably been a mistake. That's what you got to assume at this point. And sure, look really hard and bring up sigma as high as you can. But until sigma gets really good, then you can't, you know, really make too many assumptions, because the standard model is just too amazingly successful to think that it's made some big mistakes here, or that there's such a, you know, an important chunk of it is not there regarding the, you know, these types of particles and forces. And don't forget, though, Steve, Fermilab has gone over 6% of its experimental results. What we are talking about today because of its 6% of what it's gone over. So we're going to have to wait a couple years before it analyzes all the data. And maybe they'll shoot, maybe they'll hit 5 sigma. Maybe they'll go to 6. Who knows? But we're going to have to wait until that happens. If they do get, you know, if they do get over, well over 5 sigma, and they could replicate it and all that good, and we say, yep, this looks, you know, we have to think that this is real. Then that would be fantastic. And as my smart friend Leonard Tremiel says, he's recently described, he said, when an experiment overturns theory, and that does happen, it has happened in the past, an experiment actually overturns a theory, that usually leads to a couple of possibilities. In this case, the overwhelming likelihood is that the standard model would be tweaked, but essentially remains the same. And that would be kind of like, a disappointment.
Just a refinement,
but,
right?
But, you know, this is what I'm expecting to happen, that they're going to find this particle and force, and that a new force, that's a reason to get drunk right there. You find a new particle and force like this, absolutely start drinking. That's wonderful. I mean, Kara will be telling her kids when she's, you know, in 80s. Like, I remember when Bob first talked about this on the show. Absolutely. Yeah. And that would be great. But there's a much less likely, but a very real possibility that this opens up whole new concepts and models for physicists to use to potentially explain things that the standard model definitely cannot deal with, like gravity, like dark matter, and how Jay's meatballs can taste so damn good. The standard model goes nowhere near any of that stuff. And so there's definitely gaps in the standard model that we need theories for that we don't have. So those are the kinds of theories. So those are the kinds of breakthroughs worth waiting for. So
Jay's
keep, your,
secret
eye, keep
ingredient
your eye on this one.
Is muons.
Yes.
Yeah.
Muon balls.
Yeah. So, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, we learned that there was some kind of experimental error or calculation error, like there's, or the way that they're calculating or measuring the result is off, because this is tricky.
Because
business.
It's happened before, right?
Yeah, and it's a right. good. It's happened so many times before that's, you know, a good first assumption. And then if this is real, I think it's most likely that we're going to get a tweak to the standard model. That the standard model is correct as far
Absolutely.
As it goes, but it's missing a little piece.
Right.
And then I think the major change in fundamental physics is the least likely outcome here. But of course, that would be the most exciting.
Right, and it's still possible. And don't forget, this isn't the first experiment. This is a follow up on the Brookhaven experiment from 2001, and this just refined it and made much more refined results, much better results, still pointing to this anomaly. So that's kind of like a second confirmation here.
Well, that's all exciting, Bob, but I think I may be able to outdo you.
We'll see. try.
So we've been talking about CRISPR for a long time now.
CRISPR.
So CRISPR was actually discovered when? When do you think that?
10 years ago.
2005.
Yeah, 5 to 10.
It's in the aughts.
1993.
Really? That first paper came out in the early 90s, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
But we're talking 14, about the technique.
That's 14 years before the iPhone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but obviously it wasn't being utilized the way it's being utilized.
No.
Right
the birth of the World Wide Web
in the
early
90s.
Right?
Yeah.
So in 2013... That's when they figured out how to use the CRISPR-Cas9 system for gene editing.
Oh,
that's what
okay.
you guys were thinking of. But really, that was 20 years after the discovery of CRISPR, which is, you know, that's how things work in science, right? The basic science is usually some cool application comes decades later. And, you know, CRISPR, which stands for...
We've been through that before.
Clustered, something regularly interspaced, regular. Short palindromic repeats.
Repeats. Right. I mixed up the R's. Damn it.
You know, I just memorized that goddamn acronym yesterday. I looked at it. I don't want to forget this. I don't want to forget this the next time Steve asks.
Short palindromic repeats. All right.
Oh my God.
But
so
which is, you know, you had recombinant DNA technology in the 70s, 80s, mm-hmm. and then in the 80s, we discovered the zinc fingers, and that was the first programmable.
Jay, pull my zinc finger.
Zinc fingers, baby. That was the first programmable sort of genetic modification, but it takes a long mm-hmm. time to do. It's expensive. And then in 2011, there was Talon, which was faster and cheaper. But it got eclipsed by CRISPR in 2013, which is much faster and cheaper. And that's really what revolutionized programmable gene editing, because you have the CRISPR itself, which is a way you can compare that. You can pair that with an RNA targeting sequence, and the CRISPR can find and match that sequence of DNA. So you could say, I want to go to the part of the DNA that has this sequence in it, and the CRISPR will go there. And it can also deliver a payload. The Cas9 is the payload. Right. And what that does is it cuts both strands of the DNA. And so we can use that to knock in or knock out genes. You know, the knockout means you make it so that the gene doesn't function. Knock in means you're adding a gene that you want to be functional. Knocking out's a lot easier. All you got to do is make that double-stranded cut. And then the most common natural repair mechanism called non-homologous end joining, or NHEJ, will put the two ends together, but usually in such a way that the gene no longer functions, because it makes some kind of a frame shift where the code gets scrambled, you know, at that area where it was cut.
Yeah, I never realized that, Steve, because CRISPR does the hard work of cutting, and then it just like walks away and it's like, yeah, the mate will clean this up, you know.
Yeah, basically.
Here.
Lets the cell's own repair mechanisms take over. If you want to knock in a gene, however, you have to use the much less common form of cellular repair that's a lot slower. But this is the homology-directed repair, HDR, and that, if you do it correctly, can maintain the structure of the gene so that it will still function. That's more complicated to pull off. But with CRISPR, you have targeted, programmable targeted way of either knocking out or knocking in a gene wherever you want in the DNA. Obviously, there could be off-target changes. We always talk about that. That's not perfect. You know, researchers have learned how to sort of dial up and dial down the speed and specificity of CRISPR. So we're sort of really we're still on the steep part of the curve. We're really learning how to control it a lot better. Well, all right, now it comes to, a pretty significant advance in CRISPR technology, pairing CRISPR with a new payload. This is a single dead Cas9 fusion protein, whatever that means, right? That's the payload now. And this doesn't cut the DNA. It doesn't change the DNA at all, in fact. What it does is methylate the DNA.
Yes, it's methylate, baby.
Yeah, it adds methyl groups to the base pairs. And this is a natural mechanism that is used for, like, an epigenetic change that can affect transcription. So the methyl groups basically get in the way of the transcriptase enzyme so that it's not able physically to turn that DNA into a protein. Right,
but it's reversible, right?
Into an mRNA and then into a protein. But since it doesn't alter the sequence of the DNA, it's reversible because the structure of the gene is intact. So what does this mean? It means you can use CRISPR with the single dead Cas9 fusion protein, which they're calling CRISPR off. You can do that to turn off a gene. You say, I want to turn this gene off, methylate it, and turn it off. Now, going into the research, which established that the effectiveness, that the CRISPR off works, the assumption was that this would only work in about a third of the genes.
Right.
Because there's something called canonical CpG islands.
Like dead zones or, yeah, islands, yeah, yeah.
The canonicals are CGIs, and the CGIs are, you know, where the methylation happens normally. So they figured, okay, so it's only going to work on the third or so of genes that have these CGIs. But when they did the study, they found that no, it works on almost every gene.
Almost
it's not all limited. It's not limited to the CGIs. Not
why did they got drunk would, that night?
I don't understand, Steve. Why did they think it would only work on a fraction of them?
Because previous evidence suggested that this methylation process only works on genes that contain these CGIs. So this is just based on previous research. So this basically contradicts that previous research, which means that what we thought was true about CGIs isn't true. That they're not necessary for methylation to work. And therefore, this methylation CRISPR-off technique works on almost all the genes that they tested it on.
Why almost, though? Is there a little holdout of a few percent?
Yeah, it's not 100%. It doesn't work. They didn't work every single time, but basically on most genes.
So we can turn off some pretty nasty stuff?
Well, we'll get to the applications in a moment, but potentially, yes. The other thing they found was they didn't know how long this was going to last. Maybe it would last just in the cell that they did it to. But in the descendant cells, right? If that cell, you know, copies itself, mm-hmm. the copies would revert back to the unmethylated, you know, active gene state. And what they found is no, it persists pretty much as long as they studied it. It's semi-permanent.
God. Talk about a best case scenario.
Did they do this in somatic and germline cells?
So that I don't know if they did it in germline cells.
So when you say that, Steve, it means that they make a change and the change stays forever.
As long as they've looked at it.
Forever is strong because if it is an epigenetic phenomenon, it's very likely that it would go away eventually.
Yeah, exactly.
But through multiple rounds of division, it's mm-hmm. sticking around.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
That's cool. That's really cool.
So that makes it really useful, right?
Because the truth is, if it does go away, you just do it again.
Booster shot.
But it doesn't go away immediately. It lasts for quite a long time. So this means that you can cause reversible turning off of a gene that it pretty much applies to almost any gene and persists for a long time. And they made CRISPR on to turn the gene back on. So now we have an on-off switch for any gene.
Oh, that's awesome.
Is that incredible or what?
Yeah. Now,
the
question is, how incredible is this? Why are we getting so excited about this? So first of all, for just genetic research for genetic research itself, the ability to cheaply, quickly, semi-permanently, and reversibly turn off and on genes is a huge boom.
Oh, yeah. This is instead of breeding an animal that's a knockout animal and then like having to rear the animal and then do experiments with it, you can just knock out the gene in a fully functional. I mean, that's amazing. Then you can have these perfect control groups right next to them. I mean, everything about this changes the game.
This is rocket fuel for genetics research. Yeah.
This is why.
You know, our knowledge of genetics has really been taking off in the last 20, 30, 40 years because our knowledge of genetics is improving the technology of genetics research. This is a great example of that. So there's a positive feedback loop in genetic research. That's why, you know, sequencing a genome today is thousands of times cheaper and faster than it was 30 years ago, right? It's like computer transistor progress level. It's geometric. Mm. It's not linear. So it's absolutely amazing. All right, but what about clinical applications? You know,
bring it. So let's hear it.
Well, so this has exciting possibilities, but this is tangential to. It doesn't solve the biggest limiting factor with clinical applications of CRISPR, which is how do we get the CRISPR into the cells we want to get them into. We still need a vector, right? So this is great if you're doing in vitro fertilization and you want to alter the genome of the embryo. That's great. Mm-hmm. Or if you're doing it in a cell line in a petri dish for research, fantastic.
Because then you can just inject it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And if you want to do it on something in the blood or the bone marrow or something where we can get access to it very easily.
Yeah, maybe in your eye or...
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Vitreous humor of the eye. You can inject it there. We can inject it into your spinal fluid. We can take your blood out do it to your blood, put your blood back in. We could do the same thing for your bone marrow. So anything like that, but for your liver, like we can't take your liver out, CRISPR it up, and put it back in.
Right, your brain.
We can take it out, though.
For solid organs, for solid organs, you know, we just don't have a really good way of getting CRISPR to the cells we want to get them to. So that vector problem is still a huge limiting factor on all the exciting clinical applications for this. But you know, we're working on that. But you know, remember in the 1990s we had a vector problem with gene therapy. This is pre CRISPR.
Cause of death.
Retroviruses.
Yeah. Remember that kid died.
Yeah, and exactly. We ran into problems there, and it took 25 years to sort of get to the same point. You know, where we were then. You know, I mean, to fix these hurdles. So it's really hard to predict, you know, like how much of a hurdle this is going to be. We may solve it tomorrow, or it may be 30 years from now. We'll be like, oh, we're still waiting for that CRISPR, you know?
And the distinction needs to be made between treating a child or an adult who has a genetic disease and preventing genetic disease in an embryo. And that's where a lot of the ethical questions come in. Because it's much easier to... I mean, not easier, but the vector problem is less of a problem if we're talking about putting it into an embryo.
Totally.
Or putting it into a single fertilized cell.
It's not an issue at all. That Chinese scientist, Dr. H-E, it's He or He, I always forget which one it is.
Yeah.
I think Dr. He. He did it. He did it, right?
Hey.
It's done.
Yep.
So, you know, that's not a problem. It's getting it into an adult. You know, you have an adult who has a pancreas, probably one. We want to fix your diabetes in your pancreas. Mm-hmm. How are we going to get the CRISPR into your pancreatic islet cells? You know, that's what we need to figure out, for example. And that's tricky. And so we're still waiting on that. When that breakthrough happens, then the gloves are off on CRISPR. Then it's, you know, incredible. So
then it reaches every aspect of medicine.
Totally. Wow.
Literally every. I mean, it revolutionizes drugs.
So for example, they're already talking about, like, you know, as one potential application, Alzheimer's disease, part of which is overproducing tau protein. Well, we can turn the tau protein off, CRISPR off, no worries. We just need to get the CRISPR to all your brain cells, you know. That's, you know, I wonder if, like, if we just put a lot of it in the spinal fluid, if enough of it will get to the surface of the brain to that it would be, if, I don't know.
Or maybe it's worth it to...
Yeah.
Open up the skull, you know.
Well, you inject it into your. You could just stick a needle through. You just put it into your ventricles, you know. So you know, we'll see. I mean, I wouldn't. You know, again, if you have somebody who's slowly degenerating from Alzheimer's disease, that justifies aggressive research, you know. So I wonder how long it will be before we start seeing some research there. But again, we just don't know how well it's going to penetrate. You know, how many of the cells it's going to get to, and how clinically effective that's going to be. So there's still years, probably decades of research ahead of us, but this is really exciting potential.
Yeah. It's sort of like my concern, you know, not to put a wet blanket on it because it's so exciting. And again, it's almost like the way that gravitational waves are revolution. It's a new type of astronomy. This is like a new type of intervention. It's like, it's different than drugs. And when you think about drugs as an entire class, all drugs is a type of intervention. I mean, think about how the multitude of drugs that exist and how many lives they've changed.
Yeah. A powerful tool.
It's huge. Yeah. But the thing that worries me...
It's epigenetic therapy. That's how cool is that?
It's so cool. I think the thing that I'm most concerned about when I, you know, to temper my excitement a little bit just so I don't get overly, overly excited, is that much like cancer, there are certain situations in which unless you get them all... they just keep coming back.
Yeah.
And my concern would be about treating some sort of genetic, you know, whether you're turning off an expression or you're turning on an expression, if you can't get to all the cells or you can't get to a certain number of the cells, are we just chasing our tail over and over?
So I mean, that is clearly going to be an issue disease by disease, but I'll tell you, Kara, I think that, you know, just my general medical knowledge, you know, that, so many things, the negative clinical effects come in when you start to affect 60, 70, 80% of the cells.
That's
are
so
diseased.
Good to hear.
Yeah.
Like herd immunity.
You lose 70% of your kidney function and then you start to notice kidney disease. Like there's a lot of reserve built in to so many parts of your body. Like you could lose a lot of your liver and be fine.
So yeah, and something like Alzheimer's, where it's cumulative, right?
Yeah, it's cumulative.
It builds up. The proteins build up over time.
Exactly. So slowing that down would slow down the progression of the disease. Yeah. And maybe so much that, because it progresses over decades, if you slow it down so that you're probably going to die of something else before it becomes significant, then who
And cares? We see that with targeted cancer treatments now. When we have a molecular marker on a tumor and we're able to treat with a targeted oral chemotherapy, a pill, as opposed to radiation or intense chemotherapy that's sort of not as targeted, we see people who have metastatic cancer living for decades, certain types, because they're able to keep the tumors at bay. It doesn't mean they go away all the way, but if they can keep them under a certain threshold...
Yeah, they're not cured, but they're in remission to the point that that's not what they're going to die from.
Yeah, right? They're just carrying the disease. They're keeping the disease in check.
So a lot of things, like when I think of the diseases and what I know about them, most of them would respond very well to this kind of treatment. Even though it's partial, it would have a significant effect. Even like sickle cell, you don't need to make every single blood cell normal. You just need enough of them to be normal that you don't go into a sickle cell crisis.
Well, and can you imagine like the mental health applications too, like expressing more or less of a neurotransmitter? There's so much cool stuff here.
Imagine, how about this? Imagine you get this deployed somehow to every cell in your body, just waiting, you know, for you to tweak it, to methylate some gene, and, you know.
But you have to do that. It's still targeted. You have to tell it what to methylate.
I know. I'm assuming we've solved the problem of delivery, and then you have an app. You get an app, and you say, all right, I want to deactivate this gene and soup up this gene, deactivate that one.
See, when you go to
Bob's
your techno-optimist place...
Bob's his smartphone. He could see
when he goes to that techno-optimist place, I get horrified. And I'm like, no, we don't want this.
It is a moment to pause, definitely. Yeah.
Steve, what do you think would be the early applications?
Well, in research. This is going to be used for research first. Absolutely. Clinical, I think, will be, again, things where CRISPR can target the tissue, like in the blood and whatnot.
And also probably like severe life-threatening, like cystic fibrosis, like, you know, these very specific types of diseases, right? That's where we're going to see research applications.
For cancer, what if we can get enough of it into the cancer that it turns off the cancer mutations? You're no longer a cancer cell, you know?
I know. Yeah. I mean, it would be insane. I mean, I just think of all the like... especially all the genetic diseases that we know are a simple switch. It's like, you know, my body produces too much of this one protein.
Single gene, yeah.
Yeah, like those are, like phenylketonuria. I don't know if that's single gene, but it's like, it's such a specific thing. It's like just, I turn this one compound into another compound and that builds up. So if I can just stop doing that, or I can't clear a compound, or, you know, my liver produces too much of something. Like, you look at all of those types of applications, and it's just like, it's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah, it'll be easier for things where mutations where you don't produce something, then this would not be as obvious an application here. Because this is turning something off, right?
Yeah, but they have the on switch now, too.
But that's only to turn back on something they turned off.
Maybe, but I bet you soon we'll figure out how to turn things on that weren't there. Because I bet you it's in your DNA.
Not if you have a mutation in a gene and the gene is off, not because it's methylated. It's off because there's a frame shift mutation, and now it can't be transcribed.
You're right, you're right.
Snip it out, knock it back in.
Well, now you're talking about knocking in a gene. That's not CRISPR on off. That's
right.
That's Cas9. That's some other application of CRISPR. Just want to keep things
have.
In their lane.
Yeah.
So they're just different CRISPR applications that we would use in different things. Like, I don't think they would be using this for GMOs, because you want to make permanent genetic changes in a GMO, stable GMO line. You don't want to just make epigenetic changes. Although, what I said when I was writing about this is like, it wouldn't surprise me if they figure out how to make an epigenetic change to make a crop better. And of course, it goes away after a while. So it's like built-in patent protection, because it's not permanent.
Oh, brilliant.
Nice.
But they already have that with hybrid seeds, by the way, before you get all, anti-corporate.
Yeah,
the hybrid seeds can't be, you can't breed them again, because that's only for one generation do you get that perfect mix of genes.
Yeah.
So this would be the similar kind of thing.
But this gives you like a slightly longer lease.
Yeah, right.
Love it.
All right, Jay, this is, I've been reading about this. I'm not really sure if this is good news or not, but apparently our carbon emissions are down. Tell us about that.
You don't know if it's good news or not?
Well, go ahead. Tell us what's going on, and we'll dig into it.
So as climate change becomes more and more of, you know, a looming mess around the world, the United States seems to be starting to actually try to get their carbon emissions under control. So far, 17 states, Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico have enacted laws that will enable reaching the goal of getting to 100% carbon-free electricity production over the next 2 decades. Now, 2 decades puts us into 2040, and a lot of times you'll hear the date 2050 thrown around as the goal. According to this study, that's 10 years before, you know, that 2050 date that has just been thrown around for the last few years. So this is really good news, and it's also supported by historical data that shows that it's definitely possible to have significant reductions in carbon emissions. That, you know, people just have to do things. The Department of Energy released new research outlining how things have progressed in the last 2 decades. This actually goes back to 2005. If no measures were put in place to reduce carbon emissions, there would have been an increase from 2,400 to 3,000 million metric tons from 2005 to 2020, right? So that's 2,400 to 3,000 million metric tons. That was the expected increase. The actual emissions reduced to 1,450, right? So they were saying that we were going to go from 2,400 to 3,000 in those 15 years, yeah. And we actually went down to 1,450 million metric tons.
Wow.
That's 52% below the projected level that we expected to get to. Mm-hmm. So this reduction in carbon emissions, it's left a significant impact in different ways, right? And this is all good. First, the number of jobs in electrical power production increased by 29%. Of course it did, because look at the explosion of, you know, solar panels and wind farms and everything over the last decade and a half. They also saw an 18% drop in consumer electricity costs, which that's also significant. Where, you know, how come people are using less electricity? We have more electronics now than we ever did. This resulted in an $86 billion savings per year. So these changes were due to a couple of things: better governmental policy and technological advances, like efficiency as a big factor.
LED
here.
Lights.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. So the total demand for electricity didn't change much between 2005 and 2020. Back in 2005, they predicted that there would have been a 24% increase in electrical demand by the year 2020, but it never happened. So in part, like I said, this was because of more energy efficient products, advancements in technology, and improvement in government policy. In 2020, wind and solar generated 13 times more power than they predicted we would be at in 2005. Now, I can give the version of us in 2005 a break, because we didn't realize just how fast the technology was actually going to take off, which is, you know, an incredibly huge factor in how much we've purchased into, or, you know, bought into solar and wind technology. But, you know, the technologies have just really exploded, and that's why we're using them much more than we ever thought we were going to. Another significant factor in the report about lowering carbon emissions was moving from coal to natural gas. Now, you might ask, what's the big difference? There's a huge difference.
What's the big difference?
Coal is so much more dirty than natural gas. I mean, it watches all the bad porn, the bad stuff. So natural gas is just a cleaner fuel. That's it. So it's a better way to go. Because less oil products were being burned, there was a reduction in sulfur and nitrogen compounds. This, you know, this has been incredible, because it led to a decrease in respiratory disease, and way more impressive is that there was a decrease in premature deaths. It dropped from 38,000 to 3,100 per year. That's fantastic.
Wow.
Yeah. So apparently, you know, if we stop burning poison and stop putting poison into our atmosphere, people live healthier lives.
What are you trying to say?
Look, I'm not trying to take a positive here. I'm just reporting, but this was a fantastic report. So wind, solar, and battery technology are going to have a significant role in lowering carbon emissions moving forward. Many projects are in the works to help get down to a zero carbon emitting power sector. But of course, it's going to take real legitimate vigilance to make sure that it actually happens. We've talked about this on the show many times, but the infrastructure requirements are going to skyrocket. In order for us to support, you know, having renewables be supplying the vast majority of our power, And, you know, again, having cars on, the electric cars and everything that we want to do, our entire grid has to change. The grid will have to be able to ensure electricity is delivered, right? Look at what just happened in Texas. You know, they didn't spend some money to winterize their windmills, and they got, you know, smacked with a massive thing. Lots of people lost their lives. You know, houses were tons of damage to property and everything because they had a cold spell. You know, we have to be willing to spend the money. You know, we also need to build a new transmission infrastructure, right? The grid itself has to be redone, re-engineered. And this is no small feat. The way that the grid operates will have to be, it's going to have to be incredibly more efficient. We're going to have a new management system for the grid. You know, it has to be able to be operated in a different way than it's operated now. You know, we have ways of passing electricity from place to place and things like that, but we're really going to have the grid be has to have a real intelligence behind it. We have to use more nuclear energy, solar thermal, geothermal energy, longer duration energy storage. Could possibly be achieved by using hydrogen, bioenergy, synthetic fuels. I mean, there's all these different things that we can do to not just collect the energy in better ways, but to store it and to have it be on demand. And these have to be – the engineers have to get to work, you know, because this is going to take a Herculean effort in order to change the grid as quickly and as seamlessly as possible. The past 15 years have clearly shown us that we are terrible at predicting the future. I think I know a couple of people who are writing a book about how bad people are at predicting the future. Mm-hmm. So what we do know is that technology and governmental policy are essential in order to make these changes happen. Now, the technology, of course, it's happening. You know, the market is making it happen. The market-driven demand is always going to push technology forward. Look at cell phones. In summary, you know, the technology presented itself about, 15 to 20 years ago. We took it and ran. Things have gone extraordinarily well, particularly in the United States, because, you know, this is the report that I just read. It's going well in a lot of places around the world, but we've just started. This is we're nowhere near where we want to be. We want to get to 100% carbon neutral, which, you know, is that even possible? I think, of course, it is, but is it likely? Probably not. Not in anybody's reasonable lifetime. But still, the work has to be done for the next generation.
All right, now it's my turn to be a wet blanket. Ready?
Go ahead. Here you go.
So we obviously cannot extrapolate into the future. That's what they did in 2005, and they were wrong. And I don't think that, you know, these trends are not going to be easy to sustain, because I think that they represent picking a lot of technological, you know, low-hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, a big part of this is replacing coal with natural gas, which was caused by fracking, making natural gas cheaper. That's pretty much it. Not really any plan or policy or anything. It's just, well, except for allowing fracking. But there's nothing to replace natural gas with that is the equivalent of replacing coal with natural gas. Once you've done that, all we could do is just further get rid of coal. But then once we have a lot of natural gas, which releases methane and also releases some carbon, it's not going to be as easy to transition away from natural gas as it was to go from coal to natural gas. Also, the nuclear power, the big win in nuclear energy in the last 20 years was that they were able to extend existing nuclear power plants. But that's limited. They're only going to be able to do that for so much longer. In order to keep nuclear at 20% of our total generation, they're going to need to build nuclear power plants, and that's not happening. So we just delayed the inevitable with nuclear, unless we significantly invest in next generation nuclear technology. And renewables are increasing, wind and solar, because they're super cheap, but they get more and more expensive as they get higher and higher percentage of our electricity production, because you need more and more overcapacity, or you need massive grid storage, which we don't have. So none of these trends that we've seen in the last 15 years are going to continue into the future. We need all new solutions going forward, and we don't have them. And that's why I think, you know, we cannot just extrapolate. We're going to have to engineer to keep these trends going. We're going to have to build nuclear to get, in fact, expand our nuclear to get off of natural gas, because that's what natural gas can go to. We're going to need to update the grid, put in grid storage, and build a lot of renewables. And we're going to need to keep pushing efficiency higher so that, you know, we keep demand under control. And I don't think any of that's going to happen automatically. But as you say, it's hard to predict because other technologies might come into play that we're not factoring in now, and that will help. But we can't just count on that. You know what I mean? We need to engineer it.
What does it say that we've had many of the warmest years on record over the course of this decrease in emissions?
We're still putting carbon into the atmosphere. You know,
we've also got more people than we've ever had.
We're just putting
before.
Less.
We've got.
There's just less more carbon in the atmosphere than we thought we were going to have.
And remember, it accumulates, Evan. It's not like it goes in and then it goes out. Like every time we add carbon, it's accumulating because the oceans can't sink it all. The forests can't sink it all.
I suppose my point is that even despite these better habits that we seem to be getting into in some ways, it's still not having the impact on the environment that we need it to have.
Evan, to put it into perspective, if we had zero carbon emissions starting today, temperatures are still going to rise for decades from the carbon we've already put into the atmosphere.
Right.
Right.
And so we have to be coming up with efforts that actually actively reduce. Like when Jay said, like, Jay's like, I'm a bit cynical that we're going to get to carbon neutral. We need to actually be carbon negative.
Yeah, of course.
That's the only way this is actually going to level out.
But I'll take carbon neutral over putting more carbon.
Me too. Me too.
Oh, well, sure. Yeah, you want to slow it.
Yeah.
But. All right. And Carrie, you have a quick sort of related news item about talking about carbon sinks, right? Because carbon needs a place to go. And we think about trees and whatnot, but, you know, the ocean's a big carbon sink, too.
Yeah. So we know that the water itself is a carbon sink, and we'll kind of get into that. But there's one aspect of the ocean that I don't think we often talk about, and that is seagrasses. Seagrasses are everywhere. They're on they're around six of the seven continents, and they make up these basically sea meadows or these sea forests. And the interesting thing is that seagrasses are enormous carbon sinks. They can store more than twice as much carbon per square mile as land forests do. And globally, their roots are thought to trap over 10% of the carbon that's buried in ocean sediment every year. Seagrasses also buffer against ocean acidification. We know that this destroys the calcium carbonate shells of a lot of species, including coral. And that's a huge and devastating result of carbon being sunk into the ocean, because obviously once it is added to water, H2O, it forms carbonic acid. So the ocean actually acidifies. The pH gets lower. And so they buffer against that. There was a study in 2021, just this year, that showed that along the California coast, seagrasses could potentially reduce local acidity by up to 30% across extended periods. And they also help with other things. They can help clean water. They can help support fisheries, you know, produce nurseries, protect coast from erosion, even trap microplastics, and they're literally everywhere. The problem is when it comes to seagrasses, we have really limited data. There are huge holes in the data. Like when you look at maps, there are just whole areas that have never been mapped. So we really don't know how much seagrass we have on the planet. Really old estimates that are also incomplete say that maybe 300,000 square kilometers, so that translates to 115,000 square miles of seagrasses exist. Again, I mentioned six of the seven continents, you know, not including Antarctica. So it's about an area the size of Italy, if you were to add that together. But there could be much more that we haven't discovered. But here's the sad part. Human activity, like pollution from mining, damage from fisheries, dredging, acidification, like I mentioned before, it destroys the equivalent of a soccer field of seagrasses every 30 minutes around the world.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, according to the UN Environmental Program. And so here's an example. If we look at the last century, so the last 100 years in the UK, 92% of seagrasses disappeared. And estimates show that if they were still here, 400 million fish could be supported and 11.5 million tons of carbon would have been captured. That's the same as 3% of their total emissions within the year. It's thought that seagrass meadows are being lost at a rate of 7% per year globally. And again, this is based on incomplete data. It could potentially be worse. So this is an example of a mitigation effort, neutralization, maybe even a negativization. Yes, I made up that word. Effort that we have right in our backyard, but because of human activity, the same activity that's causing the climate crisis to begin with, we're also losing the very organisms that could help us buffer against our activity. And so, A, we need to recognize this. B, we need to enact legislation and work very hard to protect the seagrasses that we have left. You know, we spend a lot of time thinking and talking about the Amazon rainforest, which is fundamentally important to biodiversity, and it's fundamentally important to carbon sequestration. And of course, we're destroying it with gold mining, among other things, habitat loss, et cetera, et cetera. We can't also ignore these forests that exist within our oceans that are even potentially better at sequestering carbon. We can't let them fall by the wayside because they are not technologies we have to develop. They're already here. And so we need to protect them.
One more thing to worry about.
But also one more thing that if we do it the right way, could be a boon. You know,
no, that's true. Really, like every problem is something that can be fixed that could make it better.
And the cool thing is, if we fix this problem, not only is the problem of the seagrasses going away fixed, but it also contributes to correcting some of the wrongs of climate change.
Yep. All right, Evan, you brought this up to me, this next news item, and you said you don't think we've ever talked about this on the show. And I don't remember that we have. Have we ever talked about the Pharaoh's Curse?
Mm.
Good question. And I couldn't think of a time that we did, Bob, Jay.
Yeah, I'm already scared.
Yeah.
You should be scared. Well, when the documentary titled Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy hit the silver screen in 1955, it brought up more questions than answers. Questions like, what exactly is the Pharaoh's Curse? And can the dead become animated? And did they really turn the tomb into a nightclub at the end of that movie? Well, So thank goodness we are now discussing this. We're going to put this long dry spell to rest, and we can give thanks to recent news developments. Earlier this month in April, 22 mummies were transported from the Egyptian Museum in Tahrir Square to their new home, the National Museum of Egyptian Civilization. And this was an elaborate royal procession. I don't know if you guys saw any video of them moving these mummies, but this thing was... Well, they dubbed it the Golden Parade, and it was elaborate, to say the least. Spotlights everywhere, honor guards on horseback. There was a Philharmonic orchestra to greet the royal remains as it arrived. The president of Egypt was performing the ceremonial duties. And, it's designed to spark and rekindle interest in Egypt's rich collections of antiquities. And, you know, certainly their tourism has almost entirely stalled because of what's happened with the coronavirus pandemic. So time to get people, you know, interested again. And what better way than make a big celebration out of it? But moving the mummies is not without peril. Now, I'm not talking about the physical remains or the sarcophagi in which they were contained, which is actually an interesting process. They put them into oxygen-free, nitrogen-filled capsules on trucks with special shock absorbers to limit any damaging effects of actually transporting them and risk of humidity contamination or bacteria and insects and other things. So they really did a good job of keeping these things protected. But the ceremony has reignited talk of the Pharaoh's Curse. This curse is legendary. It is omnipresent and very much alive, even in the age of social media. For example, remember the ship that clogged up the Suez Canal for a week?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. How could we not?
Just a couple weeks ago. Social media says, hey, this is part of the Pharaoh's Curse. And you can see all kinds of tweets and other things about people speculating that, yep, because they were getting ready to have this big ceremony and moving the mummies around, Pharaoh's Curse comes up again. Oh, also, there was a train crash occurred in the country and it killed a lot of people. This is just a few weeks ago. And what did they attribute that to? Yep, the Pharaoh's Curse. And a recent building collapse in central Cairo, there it is, the curse again, all in anticipation of these mummies being disturbed. So there was a lot of news surrounding it and about the Pharaoh's Curse as well. Now, NBC News, and I looked at a whole bunch of other news organizations, they all reached out to this gentleman. He seems to be the prominent Egyptian archaeologist, Zahi Hawass, former Minister of State for Antiquities Affairs for Egypt. Dr. Hawass, who's an expert, has declared there's no Pharaoh's Curse. Okay, well, that's a relief. But all right, what is the Pharaoh's Curse? And since we haven't talked about it, I'll go into it a little bit. Now, it's sometimes called King Tut's Curse, which maybe we've heard in you know, at some point, maybe in a Bugs Bunny cartoon a long time ago. King Tutankhamun's tomb was discovered in Egypt's Valley of the Kings back in late 1922. Wow, we're coming up on 100 years. Time goes by quickly. But that incredible and historic discovery, with it came a dreaded curse, which befell all those who dared disrupt the ancient kings buried over 3,000 years prior. So saith the legends, and therefore it must be true, right? Now, is there any evidence, though, to back up the claims of a dreaded curse that lay upon all those involved in the discovery? Well, there is. First of all, they're all dead, so explain that.
Mm-hmm.
You can't. No, there are actually stories that helped develop the curse myth. This was back in 1923 and the following few years. So in the 1920s, this all sort of gelled together. We're familiar with the name Howard Carter?
Yeah.
I would hope.
Don't know.
He is one most heavily credited with the discovery of King Tut's tomb.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yep. Yep. So there's him, but he's not one of the, although eventually they attributed the curse to his death, which took place like 16 years later. But in any case, Carter had partners and a lot of people who obviously helped in the effort. Among them was, George Edward Stanhope Montagu Herbert, the fifth Earl of Carnarvon. Oh, yeah, that's a mouthful. Mm. Now, this guy was a British aristocrat. You know, as if I needed to explain that. But he had a more than passing interest in Egyptology. He was actually quite essential in making sure that this happened. Probably wouldn't have been possible without his backing. Now, the Earl died on March 25th, 1923. This is very shortly after the discovery was made public. So how do we explain that? Must have been the curse, right? Well, he actually died from a mosquito-carried disease, as did lots of people around the world at that time. Time in history. But the Earl's half-brother, Colonel Aubrey Herbert, who also entered the tomb at one point, well, he died a few months after the Earl. So how do you explain that one? Well, towards the end of Herbert's life, he became totally blind, and he received some very bad medical advice, which persuaded him to have all of his teeth extracted to help restore his sight.
Oh, what?
So maybe he died as a result of infection from tooth removal?
I find it hard that anyone would believe that.
Right.
That was a really common treatment for mental illness, too.
Oh,
I mean, not common,
gosh.
Common, but yeah, it happened in asylums a lot.
It's horrific. It also led to a lot of health problems and death, obviously, for people. I won't bore you, but there are plenty of others. And within a few years, there were no fewer than 9 people whom they associated either directly or through affiliations with the discovery of the tomb, who what they say is either died under mysterious circumstances or led to some sort of premature death. All right. You have to understand, you can't underestimate what people will believe in any given age or time. I mean, a Pharaoh's curse, we think about it today, it has almost a cartoonish sort of feel to it. Who really even talks about, you know, the Pharaoh's curse anymore? But, you know, actually people do. They are out there and they are passing along that information and then that level of belief. And it's not that strange because you still have people who believe in things like astrology and demonic possession and ghosts and lucky charms and superstitions and all sorts of things. So there's that on that background. Maybe, though, more importantly, number two, to give it in the proper context, the 1920s, this was a time where spirituality, seances, and interest in the occult and paranormal were on the rise in a lot of Western societies, and Britain in particular, which was just coming out of the horrors of World War I. The journalism at the time was sensational, certainly. There were false reports that started to emerge from the tomb, and of course that sold newspapers, so they ran with it. There was reasons to believe that there were booby traps on the tombs themselves, poisoned, and anyone who got near there was actually becoming poisoned or received some sort of microscopic infection. And this was all properly planned out by the Egyptians or the people who put them in the tombs from years ago, a trap waiting to go off. But obviously none of that bore any fruit or turned out to be truthful at all. Now, Howard Carter himself, might bear some responsibility about the curse and its prevalence, because he would remind people that curses were, through both ceremonies and rituals and written warnings upon the tombs, the sarcophagi themselves, that these curses were in place. But there was a practical reason for that 3,000 years ago, as it was in Carter's time when he made the discovery. And that was to, what? Prevent looting. Grave robbing. You had to concoct stories to get people to stop going in there to take these artifacts and things. So there's sort of this practical reason as to why you would want there to be a curse. But obviously people, you know, will take that to various degrees of seriousness. And then finally, when they've looked into it, to declare that any significant number of people associated with the discovery died prematurely or through mysterious means, it's nonsense. The numbers do not bear it out. It has been studied. In fact, one particular study in the 1930s, I believe, showed that they tracked 58 people who were present when the tomb and the sarcophagus were opened. They tracked them over the course of their lives, and only 8 had died within a dozen years. And statistically speaking, for the time, that was right on par for the course. In fact, even a little bit better than average for what people were expected to live without, you know, the need for calling into effect a curse to make that explanation. So the curse of the pharaoh, or the pharaoh's curse, alive and well, and still comes up anytime you talk about mummies and these sorts of artifacts. And amazing to think that 100 years later, it's still prevalent.
Well, it's one of those just iconic things that's never going to go away, you know?
Never.
The pharaoh's curse. And of course, there's a lot of cognitive bias behind it, you know, the pattern recognition. You know, look, bad things happened, you know? Yeah, like bad things don't happen. We don't need a pharaoh's curse to make bad things happen. That's just life.
Right. But we also, you know, we approach this from like a purely kind of secular scientific perspective. And of course, there are probably a fair amount of people who, for whom spirituality and religion is like fundamental to their worldview. So it probably doesn't seem quite as bananas to them. It's so imbued in culture and society. They've been hearing it from the time they were born.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy.
As you know, we gather together at this time each night to explore the supernatural and to tear aside the veil of darkness, to prove that ghosts and apparitions are only figments of man's imagination, to show that wherever there is mystery, it's been created by human hands.
Pretty cool, huh?
I love it.
You guys have had any idea?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's not, I don't think it's Orson Welles.
It's a dog making weird noises.
Wouldn't that be crazy? It's like a parrot. It's a parrot reading a news. Yeah,
it's from a time that you could, yeah, right? It's like from what decades would you say this could possibly be from?
40s well, or 50s.
Radio.
30s,
yeah. Even. Yeah, it's totally got that old school radio.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
Yeah.
All right, well, we have some guesses. We haven't heard from Visto Tutti recently, and here's his guess. He says, this one is confusing. Had me analyzing for ages. The recording may be old, but not as old as it seems. The musical theme is late 1960s, but the audio is artificially made to sound like the 40s. The actor affects a slight British tone in places, but inconsistently, so not natural. So I roll the dice. Mm-hmm. He's saying that it was Kolchak, the Night Stalker from 1974.
Oh, I love that show.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty cool guess. Not correct, but I do like the effort that you put into it. So you are still a warrior as far as I'm concerned. Michael Blaney wrote in and said, hi, Jay. It really sounds like The Twilight Zone, but with a skeptical twist, which is neat. The kind of show where there's someone on the wing. This is what he wrote. Something, remember? No. If I had to hazard a guess, I'd say it's Rod Serling recording that never made it to the air because sadly no one wanted to see a skeptical version of The Twilight Zone. That is also incorrect, but a very fun guess. I have another guess, and this one happens to be the winner. Check this out. Michael Collier wrote in and said, hi, Jay. This week's noisy is a lyre bird repeating an old recording from the Batman Mystery Club.
What? Ah, right. I just said, is it a bird?
Holy crap.
But it has nothing to do with a bird. He was just joking when he said that because lyre birds can mimic anything. So the answer is this is a recording from a radio show that never made it to the air called the Batman Mystery Club.
Cool.
So I will now defer to the person who sent this in. Octavio wrote in and said, back in the 1950s, there was an attempt to make a Batman radio show as a spinoff of The Adventures of Superman. From the old radio show website article, in 1950, an audition program was recorded, the Batman Mystery Club, Although Batman and Robin were featured in the program, it had little to do with the characters fans had come to know and was never broadcast. So that's really cool. Very interesting idea that they made a skeptical Batman and Robin Mystery Club radio show back then. You know, when I heard that voice, I'm like, oh my God, this is really just, it's so perfectly old school radio, and I just wanted everyone to hear it. So thank you, Octavio, for sending that in. Thanks, everyone, for your guesses. I do have a new noisy. This noisy was sent in by a listener named William Grew Mullins. And check this one out. It's got a long tail on there. So please be specific when you send in answers for this, because, you know, if you say that it's like a loud noise, that's not going to actually do anything for you. You can email me in at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. So I did see on Reddit that someone was asking like where they should submit emails to me. Can you do an attachment? What's the ideal? Everything. So let me just give you the quick who's that noisy cheat sheet. One, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. If you send it anywhere else, you have a very small chance that I'm going to actually use it, because I just go through my email at the appropriate time when I'm preparing this segment. Number two, you can absolutely send an attachment when you send an email to me to that email address. Number three, if you want to be nice, you could convert whatever it is into a WAV file for me, but you don't have to do it. I've never asked anyone to really even do that before, but if you want to, you can. That is the ideal state in which I prepare these. But, you know, someone on Reddit was asking, so there are all the answers. Please do send me in any cool noises you heard this week. And again, that's WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right, so guys, we have Nexus coming up, and to help us talk about Nexus is the MC, George Robb. George, how you doing, man?
Hi. Oh, I'm the MC. I'm the MC. That's right. Oh, my goodness. So exciting. How's everybody?
Good, man.
Hi, guys.
Hi, George.
And
George.
Persons.
So we have a couple of things to talk about. I know we've been mentioning like a save the date for Nexus, but we have some actual updates. But George is going to start. We're actually going to solicit some things from our audience for the conference. George, tell them about it.
Yeah, so we were like thinking of doing something. We always do something on the night before Nexus. We always do the Friday night. There's like a preview thing. And even when we're in the virtual world, we still wanted to do a preview. Last year, we had a game show and some fun stuff. And this year, we're going to have a special keynote. But in addition to having a special keynote, we thought, wouldn't it be interesting? Wouldn't it be cool to get all of you out there involved? And not you five on the SGU, but you out there listening, you with the headphones on right now. Maybe we can get you all involved. And we had this thought of, over the last year, we've all been locked away. We've been in our homes. We've been quarantined. And we are sure that some of you have come up with some interesting things over this time period. Some interesting problem solvers, maybe an invention, maybe some kind of a art project, maybe some kind of a something that, you know, you finally had time to work on that thing you always wanted to work on. And you did it. Maybe you solved some problem that was happening in your garden. Maybe you designed some kind of rocket ship that could take you in safely to the grocery store to get Jell-O. Whatever you may have invented, we want to hear about it. And we're going to hear about it from you folks. And then we're going to feature the ones that we think are the most interesting and maybe the most sort of special. So basically, Friday night, we're going to have a feature of cool stuff that you all out there in the wonderful SGU audience have invented. And the way you can get and be a part of this is sending us a video. Send us a 2-minute long video showing your invention, your fix, your something that you cobbled together to make work better. Maybe that symphony that you wrote, maybe that mural that you worked on in your kitchen or whatever it may be. Send us a 2-minute video. You can upload it to nexus.org/pandemic projects. And we're going to pick a bunch of you, and the coolest ones will feature on the Friday night pre-Nexus show, and we'll have you on live as well, and we'll chat with you. Won't that be fun? Guys, I am so excited for this.
Yeah, it could be a lot of fun. So, like, what cool thing did you do during the pandemic that you otherwise would not have been able to do?
Yeah, yeah.
And it could be anything.
It could be anything.
George, I figured out how to gain a lot of weight.
Same.
Yeah, same. It's yeah. The how to efficiently make cookies is pretty much where I'm right. what I was doing for the last year
and consume them.
And consume them, right, without even chewing. It's like a duck. I just sort of, yeah, entire tubes of cookies.
I've been doing a longitudinal study in binge watching. It's coming very well. I have all my data gathered by
okay,
now.
Okay.
So wait, are these things supposed to be solutions to problems?
No, it could be anything.
They could be whimsical. They could be whimsical.
Just like your, think of it as your pandemic magnum opus. What's the coolest thing you've created in the past 15 months?
That's really good.
And listen up. So we have speakers that I'm going to announce now. So we have Lena Tripathi, Dr. Robert Levy, George Church, Pete Etchells. We're going to have someone from NASA come talk to us, and we have quite a few others coming. And on top of that, we have Paul Offit and Kevin Folta are going to be joining us. We're really excited. And on top of that, we are upgrading the technology. That's all I'm going to say. It's going to be cooler than last year.
How could it be cooler than last year? How is that even possible, Joe? How is that even possible?
Ian and I didn't stop trying to improve it after Nexus 2020. We kept talking about it, and we kept coming up.
That was our pandemic challenge.
Yes. I hear you. One up Nexus. Oh, cool. That'll be meta.
Yeah.
We are looking for one particular speaker that we want our listeners' help with. If anyone out there in SGU
can kidnap
land,
him
listening to this,
her?
No. All right. But what we do need, so either it could be you, or you might know somebody who works for Boston Dynamics.
Ooh.
We need an inside contact because we want somebody from Boston Dynamics to give us a presentation at Nexus. And you know, it's kind of a hard nut to crack into without knowing somebody or knowing somebody who knows somebody. So we've decided to reach out to our audience. This is really the last piece to the Nexus puzzle that we need to put into place. Everything else really is shaping up great.
And Steve, you know what? We never announced. We actually have a title for Nexus 2021. It's called The Future Has Landed. That is our theme. The science and technology of today, that's amazing. That's what the whole conference is going to be about. We know you're going to love it. I'm super excited. I don't think I've ever been more excited for a Nexus conference than this one. So please join us. Go to nexus.org, necss.org, and register today.
Yeah, and the conference is August 6th and 7th. It's Friday and Saturday, August 6th and 7th. All right, well, George, thanks for popping on the show to help us talk about Nexus.
Oh, you know me. I'll always pop on to whatever I can. Ew.
We
thanks,
do know
guys.
That about you. Yep. All right, take care, George.
Thanks, George. Bye.
Thanks, George. See ya.
All right, we're going to do one Name That Logical Fallacy. This one comes from Alec, who writes, I've listened to your podcast for a while now and love it. I got a question about a potential logical fallacy that I can't quite pinpoint. Living in Maryland, there are often discussions around the murder rate in Baltimore. Because of this, people will inevitably criticize any non-murder-related legislative political actions for not addressing the murder problem. While this may be a valid way to criticize the city council's priorities, I don't believe it is a logical way to criticize the individual pieces of legislation, as they were never designed to address the murder problem. Aside from this, the city council is certainly capable of addressing multiple issues at once. A current example of this is a proposal to add speed cameras along a major highway that enters the city. Personally, I have seen few people criticize the proposal itself. Instead, most people criticize it for not addressing the murder problem. This feels like a logical fallacy to me, but I'm not sure. Specifically, it makes me think of a false dichotomy, but again, I'm not confident in this assessment. Could you provide some insight? So what do you guys think about this kind of fallacy?
It's a straw man, no?
Well, you no. can't chew gum and walk at the same time.
Oh, fallacy. See, I was reading it as it's not fair to criticize a piece of legislation that was never designed to solve that problem anyway. That would be a straw man argument.
Yeah, but they're saying that's part of it. Again, these are informal logical fallacies. Yeah. They all blend into each other. But he's focusing on the fact that it's not just that you're criticizing it for not doing something it wasn't designed in the first place. You're criticizing it because it's not addressing this more important problem.
Right? Well,
so nothing is valuable unless it's fixing the murder problem in Baltimore. But of course, this could apply to a lot of things. It's like, why are we sending people to the moon when there are hungry people?
How we talked about this or, too.
Is that moving the goalposts? No. Which one is that?
No.
Which one is that?
No.
I'm just blanking. So this, I know exactly what it is.
I wrote an article about this fallacy because it often gets applied to skeptics. Like, why are you debunking Bigfoot? Aren't there more important things to do out there?
Right.
So this is called the fallacy of relative privation.
Yes.
That's the name of the fallacy. Yeah. Relative privation. And because there's always something more important that you could point to out there. And again, where it gets tricky is when you're applying it to an individual person or group or specific, you know, bill or whatever. It's one thing to say that, like, as a society, we need to have our priorities and we need to decide where we're going to put our resources. But if you're saying, like, why are you doing this? Or aren't there more important things to do? It is a fallacy. It's ridiculous. Like, so everybody should be trying to cure childhood cancer, like, and nobody should be doing anything
right.
else until we decide what the one most important problem is in the world, and we all should focus on fixing that before we move on to the next thing. There's a lot of reasons why, you know, you might choose to do other things, like, you know, opportunities, talent, skill,
desire.
Yeah, it's all fine. And because something is not as important as something else doesn't mean it's not important, right? As Evan was getting close to it with the false choice thing there, it's like, yes, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can fix more than one thing or address more than one issue at the same time. Mm-hmm. But it's often just a lazy way of criticizing something that you may not like for other reasons. To say, well, there are more important things that you should be spending your time on, or that we should be spending our resources on, or whatever. And it's like, yeah, we could do multiple things. And they just, if it's valuable, it's valuable. If it's a good idea, it's a good idea. It doesn't matter that there are relatively more important things out there. And importance can often be subjective, not absolute. And again, there are other criteria that might determine, you know, where it's best to put your efforts. So relative privation. Another manifestation of this might be, Karen, I think you'll appreciate this, is that why are you worried about this form of racism or sexism? We're not, you know, hanging people anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
I hate,
you know,
that.
Right. Yeah. It's like, yeah, you know, there are the, like, systematic discrimination is gone now. So you're complaining about smaller and smaller problems. It's like, yeah. But that doesn't mean these aren't real problems. Just because there were worse problems in the past.
Well, or I should even say just sometimes more obvious problems.
Yeah, whatever. But even if there were, like, yes, slavery was worse than whatever we have today. Yes, absolutely. But just because we're not fighting slavery anymore doesn't mean that there's nothing worth fighting today, right?
Yeah.
And it's the same with, I think, a lot of social progress is that, yeah, it will. We will focus on relatively smaller and smaller problems. That's a marker of progress. It doesn't mean they're not worth addressing just because there were even worse problems in the past. That's a relative privation fallacy as well.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is fake. Just three news items this week, no theme. Is everyone ready?
Let's do it.
All right, here we go.
Okay.
Item number one, a review of data from 2020 finds that death by suicide fell by 6% in the U.S. with similar numbers in other developed nations. Item number two, the Princeton Plasma Physics Lab has developed a room temperature plasma for consumers that kill 99.99% of bacteria on surfaces. And item number three, a recent fMRI study of the brains of violent criminal psychopaths and healthy controls could find no significant difference in brain function. Evan, go first.
2020, death by suicide fell 6% in the U.S. Okay. I mean, we're talking about the year of coronavirus, obviously, and a lot of mental health issues that came hand in hand with that. So this would run perhaps counterintuitive to that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that is what actually happened. Suicide may have fallen because other parts of society, as the coronavirus shut it down, meant that people weren't, say, being bullied as much because of the lack of social interaction and other things that lead to suicide. So perhaps that one's right. Then the next one, Princeton Plasma Physics Lab, a room temperature plasma killing 99.99% of bacteria on surfaces. Room temperature plasma. I bet you Bob will have some interesting things to perhaps say about that. And then the last one, the fMRI study of the brains of violent criminals. Psychopaths, ouch. And healthy controls could find no significant difference in brain function. No significant differences, I suppose, in any aspect of brain functions is how I'm interpreting this. I'll go with the fMRI study. They must have been able to detect perhaps some significant difference in brain function. It just seems too broad. How it's worded here. So I have a feeling that somewhere in there's the truth. So that one's fiction.
Okay, Kara.
I absolutely agree with Evan. I've seen too many studies that show the difference. So yeah, maybe one study showed it. I mean, that's the hardest thing when you word them this way. A recent fMRI study of what, like three people? Sure. Any study is going to show no difference or a significant difference. It's when you actually look at all of the literature together. So it kind of is like, I don't know, that's a red flag to me, but absolutely psychopathy is characteristic. Absolutely. I think plasma is like a gas, right? Or not quite a gas, but like a liquidy gas, which I did think was supposed to be hot, but maybe there's, you know, like a super concentrated gas or something as a plasma. Yeah, why not? I mean, we can kill stuff with light or with certain UV measurements. And I have a feeling that we're going to see, sadly, a really big spike in suicides in 2021 as things start to go back to, quote, normal. I actually wouldn't be surprised if there were fewer suicides during lockdown, but that the rate would actually go up and maybe even go up past what we're used to seeing this year and next year, which bums me out. But I think that that's what the data probably will bear out. So, yeah, I'm going to go with Evan. There's just so much evidence to show that their brains are different.
Okay, and Bob?
Death by suicide fell by 6. I thought I read somewhere that it went up in 2020 and it just didn't make any sense. Or maybe that was just murders. I don't know. Something went up. All right, let's look at the plasma. Yeah, plasma is basically, atoms that have been ripped apart, like charged particles. You have free electrons and other particles and protons. That's like the most common matter in all of the universe. Stars are made out of plasma. But yeah, cool plasma. So it seems counterintuitive. How could something that could rip apart atoms be kind of room temperature? But I think that can be done. I'm trying to think of specifically how they would do that. But so I think that is possible. It's meant to throw us off. So yeah, I know fMRI. I mean, that could, at first blush, it seems kind of like a coarse kind of way to observe the brain. Doesn't necessarily can show psychopathic brains, but I think Karen, Evan kind of swayed me in this direction, so I'll do a GWEC, so I'll say fMRI is fiction as well.
And Jay?
Yeah, so quickly going through these, the death by suicide fell by 6%. I'm curious to know if that's true, like what would be the reason. I'm just thinking even though the pandemic has been really stressful, people have been a lot less stressed out about their work situation. So, yeah, I don't know. That's interesting. I mean, I would tend to think that the less time people are actually physically at work, the happier they are. So that's probably true. The plasma one sounds really cool. I'd like to know, exactly how it's used. Like, what do they do with it? If it's for consumers, like, what do you just leave it? I don't know. What do you do with it, Steve? Rub it on your hands? Rub it around? What do you do?
Spray it on stuff.
You spray plasma on stuff. Okay. But just don't drink it. All right.
Can you inject
That's interesting.
It?
I'd like to know what it is that makes it antibacterial. And then this last one, I mean, I would tend to think that there would be a very significant difference between violent criminals and people who aren't violent criminals. At least something that
Not
would
just
be
violent,
detectable.
Psychopathic.
Yeah, psychopathic violent criminals. Like, an fMRI, you'd think if there's ever an instrument that we would be able to measure that, it would be that one. So out of the three, that's the one that definitely stands out to me. So I will say that one is the fiction.
All right, so you guys are all in agreement. So let's start with number two here. The Princeton Plasma Physics Lab has developed a room temperature plasma for consumers that kill 99.99% of bacteria on surfaces. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Cool.
This one is science.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. Is it expensive?
How'd they do it?
Yes. I didn't say anything about price. Mm-hmm. This is just sort of a proof of concept kind of study. They also say if you combine it with hydrogen peroxide, It kills 99.9999% of Whoa. Bacteria.
They yeah, but you also, could also just wipe things down.
Yeah, well, but it's not going to kill. If you just wipe things down with like water, you're just going to move it around. You're not.
No,
gonna
but
really
like
kill
bleach,
all the bacteria.
Lysol.
Like we have bleach.
Lysol will do it. Yeah, Lysol will do it. But
yeah, it's like you can already just spray a can of Lysol on stuff.
Yeah, but plasma.
No, but this is plasma. Lysol yeah, plasma. So
why so do the plasma that. Route, Steve? Did they say like why they invented it?
Well, I think they're just trying to come up with another consumer product, you know, that will do the same thing. This is it's room temperature and normal atmospheric pressure. They still are good. They haven't tested it for viruses yet, but they suspect it will also be affected for viruses. Obviously, that would be a nice thing to have during a pandemic, a viral pandemic. But all right, let's go to number three. A recent fMRI study of the brains of violent criminal psychopaths and healthy controls could find no significant difference in brain function. You guys all think this one is the fiction. Mm. So clearly there are differences. I mean, there's no one could reasonably argue that there isn't a difference. It's a personality mm-hmm. disorder. The question is it a difference that could be imaged on fMRI scan?
Yeah.
And, well, it has before.
And specifically with the paradigm that they used in this study for the right. difference that I they mean. Were looking for. That's the question.
And, you know, that's a shot in the dark. Maybe, maybe not.
So this one is the fiction. This Ooh, is the fiction.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Nice.
Yes.
Yeah, for the reasons that you said. So what the study found was really big differences. And so they looked at
big, huh?
both anatomically and with fMRI scan. They did regular MRI and they did fMRI. And they found that, you know, if yeah. they watched yeah, if they watched videos of violent, bad things happening, their emotional centers did not get activated in the same way that healthy controls did.
That makes sense.
On fMRI mm. study. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. But this study also found differences in well-functioning individuals who have personality traits associated with psychopathy. So
yeah.
even if you're not a violent criminal, but you like score high on the psychopath test, you still will have differences in your brain. And so to clarify what they found, so it was the control of the emotional areas that was compromised. So their mm-hmm. emotional reaction was actually higher because they lacked the, you know, the brain regions that would moderate and control the emotional
Interesting.
Reaction.
So they couldn't Which inhibit a reaction to violence.
They can't. Yeah, they couldn't wow. inhibit it. That's why they tend to be impulsive and callous. Mm-hmm. They don't have the inhibitory control,
right? Like, so, why'd you shoot that person? Why? They were in my way.
Yeah, right.
They that were, kind of yeah, yeah, yeah.
Why did some brains develop that way?
Yeah,
I mean that is a really interesting question. Yeah,
everything that can go wrong in the body goes wrong.
Yeah, just read some Oliver Sacks. By the way, have you guys seen the documentary on PBS?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, about Sacks. I want to see that.
Yeah, about Sacks.
I bet that's good.
It's
that
great.
I would want to see.
Yeah, check it out. It's out now.
All this means that a review of data from 2020 finds that death by suicide fell by 6% in the U.S. with similar numbers in other developed nations is science. And yeah, there was a lot of speculation about what the suicide rate was going to do during the pandemic because there's a lot of psychological stress associated with it. But in fact, it went down. And I stress this was in, you know, like developed nations, with the exception of Japan. Where there was, I think, a slight increase.
But there's also a lot of weird exceptions with Japan and suicide, cultural exceptions.
Yeah, just exactly. They're an outlier at baseline. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. had the biggest drop of 6%, but again, other similar nations. The idea is that it was probably, you know, when any kind of catastrophe or you know, bad situation hits, there's an initial heroic stage where everyone's sort of banding together and we'll
That's
get
why
through
I think
this, you know.
This year and next year is probably not going to look good.
Yeah, so there's definitely worry about a rebound. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, people may have been spending more time with family members and being under more careful observation just because they're not, you know, going out.
And there's a protective mechanism. I mean, there's a protective factor of being around friends and family. The problem is that the people who are really isolated and who maybe are experiencing anhedonia and who are experiencing like low energy, that kind of pandemic fatigue that a lot of us are dealing with. I mean, you see similar things in the course of a bipolar disorder. If somebody sadly does die by suicide, it's often not as they're going down. It's as they're coming back out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that's something similar here, sadly.
But they also, here's one thing that may be sustainable, is that they say it may also be the dramatic increase in the availability of telehealth services.
Yay!
So if that's the case, if that turns out to be the case, that's something that should persist.
Yes.
Expand it.
That's wonderful.
Totally. No, it's the best single thing to come out of the pandemic was the explosion of telehealth services, in my completely biased opinion. But
Mine too. Yeah.
But yeah, it's been great. And so that would be, if they can if they could identify that as a significant factor here, that would be a further boost to many more people's mental health.
Yeah, so many more people are able to be reached if they don't have to drive across town or get a babysitter or, you know, all those different reasons.
Just a push
it's also
a button and,
what my wife did her PhD in telemental health. And her research found that it's just as effective as in person, you know.
You're so biased.
Great. That's great.
Yeah. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
All right. Before I say the quote, I want to have each of you kind of give me your quick opinion on what you think about this quote, because I've had some thoughts about this very point over my years. So, common sense is a very tricky instrument. It is as deceptive as it is indispensable. And that was written by Suzanne Katharina Langer. She was an American philosopher. She was born in 1895. She died in 1985. She was a writer and educator well known for her theories on the influences of art on the mind. She was one of the first women in American history to achieve an academic career in philosophy and the first woman to be popularly and professionally recognized as an American philosopher. She was elected as a fellow to the AAAS in 1960.
Cool.
So, perhaps a forgotten superhero of science there. Cool. But at the same time, the quote itself, this is something I've thought about as well. And common sense, for me, is kind of a fair starting point, but you can't rely on it to make any final conclusions on things. How do you feel about that?
No, I agree that I think it's a very wise quote. You know, because common sense, it's like what Kara, you know, like what we would call face validity, right? Like it's a starting point.
It's like you need that first.
Yeah. Like if somebody doesn't have like make even basic sense at a fundamental level, you should be very skeptical of it, but it could be very deceptive because quote unquote common sense could just be a manifestation of your cognitive biases. You know, it could all be confirmation bias.
Yeah, it's like, are we talking about common sense or critical common sense?
Right. It's kind of like intuition. Intuition can get you 90% of the way there a lot of the time. But you have to back it up with analysis, with critical analysis, because it's often quite deceptive as well.
Also, it reminds me of humor. Like, no one wants to think they don't have a sense of humor. And similarly, I don't think anyone wants to think or will believe that they don't have common sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would take an enormous amount to convince someone that they don't have common sense.
Yeah.
Right. They'd have to have like, they would have to have proven to themselves over and over again. But, you know, typically people can't see that or admit that.
But if you have like a complete absence of common sense, it makes you vulnerable to things like believing the world is flat, you know?
Totally. Yes.
Like things that you should be rejecting on their face, you could say, hey, maybe this is true. No, it's not true.
Yeah. Like so many types of like pseudoscientific, treatments or devices where so often we're like, well, how would that even work? Like, it's so easy to just be like, that doesn't sound right. But many people, like, that doesn't make scientific sense. But many people who don't have that basic filter wouldn't know that.
Yeah. All right, guys. So we will be doing a Friday live stream going forward. Mm-hmm. We're still continuing to do that. Thank you guys for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
You got it, brother.
Thanks, thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.